If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's my passion. It's what I was meant to do, food production. And I think we've really, in addition to losing touch of where it's coming from, I think we have forgotten that food is like what grounds and centers our health. And, you know, we see the decline in our life expectancy. We see the rise in obesity. We see the rise in chronic disease, all these food intolerances, autoimmune, gut problems. And we're pointing to everything else but our food. Right? This pharmaceutical drug can fix it. This is what's the problem. And it's like, what are we eating day to day? What energy compounds are we giving our body? We are literally made up of the food that we consume. And why are we just not even paying attention to it?
Ashley Armstrong, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always excited when people are excited to talk about fatty acids, human metabolism, regenerative agriculture, how it all comes together. So this should be fun.
All the cool things.
Yeah.
First of all, I would just like to say thank you and offer my sincere gratitude because you, with your Nourish Food Club, has been nourishing my family, which is very important to me. So thank you.
Thank you for being a part of it. We're doing it together, right? I think that that's a big missing piece today is I think a lot of people buy food and there's just a complete disconnect. And in the past, like 1800s, early 1900s, people would really know who's producing their food. I think that that's a part of being human, right? Because at the end of the day, if we go back like several hundred years ago, everyone's lives revolved around food production. And now modern times, like food is inconvenient. I don't care. That's too much time, whatever. And so we've outsourced it to these huge, massive, big food companies. So it's really amazing to be able to connect. It's cool for me to be able to connect with people who are buying from us. I think it's a really cool, shared, unique experience that not many people get to experience today. So thank you. Thanks for being a part of it with us.
Sure. I'm almost reluctant to share. Sometimes sometimes I'm like, do I want to have this person on the podcast and give away these secrets? Like, is the supply going to run out?
Gosh.
I'm very selfish around food.
Yeah. I mean, food is, it's my life, right? It's my passion. It's what I was meant to do, food production. And I think we've really, in addition to losing touch of where it's coming from, I think we have forgotten that food is like what grounds and centers our health. And, you know, we see the decline in our life expectancy. We see the rise in obesity. We see the rise in chronic disease, all these food intolerances, autoimmune, gut problems. And we're pointing to everything else but our food, right? It's this. Oh, this pharmaceutical drug can fix it. Oh, this is what's the problem. And it's like, what are we eating day to day? What energy compounds are we giving our body? We are literally made up of the food that we consume. And why are we just not even paying attention to it, right? So I think it's a difficult conversation because I know that healthier food options are more expensive and they are not always available to everyone. And that's a difficult challenge. And that's something that I'm not going to deny, right? Like I'm heavily involved in the production side of things. The reality is that healthier food does cost more. Like the back end costs are significantly higher. And so now how can we make this scale in a way that lowers the cost without sacrificing quality? And I've got a lot of ideas there, but it is going to take some time. So it's just at the end of the day, going back to how we used to produce food.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it can be more expensive. I just, you know, it's like what's the hierarchy of your priorities? I mean, I wear $4 t-shirts and I'll wear them to death so that I could buy good food. I mean, everybody has different, you know, priorities.
This is the only new shirt that I got this year, and it was a gift from my sister. But other than that, like, I haven't bought new clothes. I don't care about my car. I don't know when I went on like a really fancy vacation. I, like you said, it's kind of like hierarchy of needs and where your priorities are. And I'm not saying that those aren't valuable experiences for people, but like, I would rather be able to cook healthy food than have a Versace purse. Yeah.
And you look very healthy, and you know, that is the real wealth. I mean, this sounds kind of sick, I guess, because I have two cars, but one's a 1999 and one's a 2003. So,
Run them till they die. That's
exactly.
great.
So, have you always, like, did you grow up on a farm? Have you always been a farmer, or was this a shift?
No, I grew up in the suburbs. I actually grew up as a golfer. So we lived on a golf course, you know, like country club. Golf was my life. I seriously, 8 hours a day for 12 years of my life, I played golf. It was a very serious part of my life. But definitely grew up in the suburb, had no idea of where food came from. My mom had a restaurant, so we ate out a lot there. And so I think eating out removes you even further from your food source, right? Because you don't even know the ingredients, but you also don't know who's making the food for you. So it's like this other layer of disconnect. And then even when we would cook food, I just thought food came from the grocery store because I'd never been to a farm. All I'd seen was the rows of corn stalks through the great state of Illinois that I grew up in. And I was like, wow, that's great farming, right? Look at those straight lines. Perfect corn stalks. I didn't know at the time that over 50% of the corn and soy grown in the US is not to feed humans, it's to feed livestock. So grew up completely disconnected, and at a certain point, like, that just kind of catches up to you, and it really varies person to person, right? From my journey so far, I have realized that I don't think that people are going to really care about their food sourcing or where it comes from until they face some sort of issue, health issue, right? Because you can't just tell someone, they're like, oh, I'm doing fine, I'm loving life, like there's no issue with what I'm doing right now. It's because we're all born into modern times. So we're born into this different way of living that's so different from what our great-great-grandparents. I grew up in the wrong era because as soon as I did connect with this older way of eating, older way of living, it just like lit a fire, lit a passion, and I was like, wow, I feel like a great 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 grandma living in the late 1800s, right?
Well, you're in the right area. You're
Yeah,
carrying the torch.
exactly. So I didn't care about where our food came from until I developed like autoimmune, Raynaud's, just like huge gut issues, just at a young age, right? Early 20s, I should be thriving, I should be doing well, and I just was not. I hit a wall. And at that time, I found like keto, fasting, carnivore, and I'm not doing those things now, but I think that they were a necessary step on my health path. And through carnivore, I learned about regenerative agriculture. I found a local farmer. I visited like who produced the cow, the full cow that I bought, and it was just the most revolutionary experience that I just never had before, and I wanted to tell everyone about it. I became so obsessed. So at the time, I did a lot of like volunteer work at his farm, learning about how he moves his cows, moves his pigs, moves his chickens. And I was in grad school at the time, and I started to realize that that's what I was passionate about, not what I was studying in grad school. And so I made the decision after grad school to, hey, I'm not going to be a professor. I am instead going to pursue this farming thing full time because I just can't stop thinking about it. So stumbled upon it through like health challenges and meeting my local farmer and just being so inspired by him. Farmer Dave, he will always be just like a huge, just like how you remember teachers that had a huge impact on your life, right? Meeting my local farmer was like the most transformative experience for me. And I just kept visiting more and more farms, getting as much regenerative ag experience, and was like, all right, let's just give it a go.
That's a great story. It's interesting for me. It's not the teachers I remember. They probably remember me for like, taking months off their life.
You were one of those kids.
I was one of those kids, yeah. So you alluded, so your farm has a couple unique aspects to it, and you just alluded to the idea of regenerative agriculture. It's funny because I just had company at my house recently that first insisted that pastured, grass-fed, grass-finished meat doesn't taste good, even though they raved about the 12 pounds of chuck roast that I made them that was all pasture-raised, grass-fed, grass-finished. But they also try to argue, and they live in farm country. One is a longtime farmer.
Yeah.
Telling me that regenerative agriculture doesn't work, can't work. It doesn't work because it can't work, and that you have to get chemicals and pile them onto your land to produce food. Tell me a little bit about regenerative agriculture.
Yeah, so this is a difficult problem because we've got a growing population and everyone has to eat. We all need food, right? So there are many different ways we can produce that food. And at the end of the day, there are two extremes. There's degenerative and regenerative. With degenerative, we're degrading the landscape harvest after harvest, meaning we're leaving the land with less resources and in a worse state than it was the previous year. In that type of environment, we have less minerals and micronutrients available for the plants. We have less water absorption. We've got more compaction. We have more water runoff. It's not a great environment for plants to grow in. Of course we need chemicals in those situations. Of course, like yes. Now if we go to the other side with regenerative, the whole goal is to leave the land better off than it was the previous year. And at the end of the day, Mother Nature is so much smarter than any of us. We are never going to understand how it all works. There's more microbes in a teaspoon of rumen fluid, so the liquid inside of a cow. There's more microbes in a teaspoon of that liquid than there are humans on this planet. It's another world that we're never going to fully understand, but what we can do is we can provide the resources and tools that Mother Nature can thrive with, right? So when you work with Mother Nature, there's what's called synergism. 1 + 1 = 2. 1 + 1 = 1,000. And so if you give the tools and resources, Mother Nature returns and gives you more than you could ever imagine. So it takes a little bit of a mindset shift of, okay, what's the base ground and soil that we're starting with and dealing with? If we are in a degraded landscape, yeah, chemicals are definitely going to be needed, but it doesn't have to be that way. There are tools and principles that we can implement in the way that we farm that can help return life to the soil so we can go from dirt with degenerative agriculture that requires chemicals. I kind of think of it as like a lab experiment. You're in this petri dish in a lab. You gotta put the right tinctures and combinations in, and if you don't follow the exact protocol, it's not gonna work well. And then with regenerative ag, it's like we provide the resources and tools that Mother Nature needs and watch it thrive, right? So I do think that it takes a little bit of a mindset shift, and where we are at, we're at this like transformative time, I think, because there are older farmers that are very much stuck in the conventional dogmatic way of farming. And that's just because that's all they've known, right? They grew up, I would say 1950s, we saw this huge change in how farming and agriculture was implemented at a large scale because of government subsidies, the big chemical takeovers, glyphosate, other pesticides, DDT, like we saw this explosion because we had all these resources from the World War. Crap, we spent millions of, if not billions of dollars on these huge manufacturing plants and these chemicals. What can we do with them now? Oh, let's create pesticides. So the Green Revolution changed how we did farming. And that was in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. So now we have some farmers right now that this is all they know because that's what they were born into. And you can't blame them. That's what the agriculture system teaches. That's what a lot of agriculture departments at universities teach. And if we just go back a generation previous to that, like we wouldn't be here today if farming required chemicals because chemicals are new. we somehow, humans figured out how to produce food to get us to where we are today. We wouldn't have made it if chemicals were required.
Right.
So are chemicals needed if we want to produce cheap, abundant, low quality food? Absolutely. But that's not working, right? It's just not. We produce enough food to feed 1.5 times the world population. We don't have a quality issue. We have we don't have a quantity issue. We have a quality and distribution issue, without a doubt. And so is that type of farming needed to some degree? I don't have the answer there, but I do think that there's plenty of people who are interested in returning back to these principles that have sustained generations before us that don't rely on chemicals. And we're seeing more and more farms pop up every single year that are implementing these practices. And it's not just livestock. I think when you hear the word regenerative agriculture, you often just think of cows, chickens, pork, right? Oh, those animals, you know, you have them, you have them on a piece of land, you move them to the next patch, and they spread their manure, their animal impact, and you let the previous patch rest and rebuild and regrow. That's the whole idea of rotational grazing and regenerative agriculture. Yeah, you can do that with livestock, but you can also do that with produce, with vegetables, with row crops like wheat and even corn. You can implement these regenerative agriculture practices at multiple levels of the food chain, and we've been doing it for generations prior. So it's at the end of the day, I think that regenerative agriculture is nothing new. It's nothing new. It's literally just returning back to kind of more ancestral, old-fashioned principles that we had to use before we had these toxic pesticide chemicals that allowed us to produce just like mass quantities fighting nature. So back to degenerative versus regenerative. Degenerative, you're ultimately fighting biology with chemicals. I'm sorry, biology is always going to win, because if you look back at the last 50, 60 years, this chemical stopped working. So now we got to make a new one. Right. Now we got to make a new one. Hey, it is a great time to be a big ag chemical company, because it is a great business model. One stops working, now they got to invest and build another one and another one, another one. They've got a continuous, you know, group of customers. With regenerative agriculture, we're working with biology. So we're not fighting against biology. We're working with biology.
That sounds great. That's very interesting insight about the relationship to the wartime and how things were basically repurposed as like efficient business, I guess. It does seem like so many of the issues we have, whether they're like health issues on like a math, like the population scale, or even like social, cultural issues, are somehow born on this, like, not detachment, but like this idea that we can fight or control this wisdom of Mother Nature, instead of just like, how do we harmonize this? How do we get the wind to our backs? Which seems like that's what regenerative agriculture is coming back to. And, you know, as far as I hold compassion for the older generation of farmers that is all they know, like, offer gratitude for the fact that they still help produce food to feed families and nourish communities. And also, I'm really curious and excited about like this rising of this back, getting back to the basics. And I heard one farmer talk about it not long ago that when he was asked, like, but is this scalable with this population? And he said, it's not necessarily scalable, but it's repeatable. So you can just have lots of little farms providing their communities spread out, and there's plenty of land for it.
Yeah. So back to this, you mentioned this mindset of we are smarter than Mother Nature. I call it the Bill Gates problem, because Bill Gates thinks that he is so intelligent and that no, Mother Nature got it wrong. We can solve the world problems through technology and being smarter than nature.
Block the sun.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, do I think that technology is an amazing resource that regenerative ag can implement? 100%. There are these new robotic mobile coops, these chicken coops that you can move them on your phone, right? You can have an app and you can move the coop. That's cool, because that saves you time and diesel on your tractor, and it's still working with nature. So it's leveraging technology while also being regenerative, right? this mindset that we are smarter than nature, it's all about intellectual property and market share. Like at the end of the day, that is what it is, because now we have these big food companies telling us that, hey, dairy, which we've consumed for over 7,000 years, dairy is bad for you. It's clogging your arteries. It's full of saturated fat. So bad for you. Your ancestors relied on it for generations, but now we know better and we can make this lab-made milk that's low in artery-clogging saturated fats. Trust us, it's new and it's filled with these types of fats that are better for you. At the end of the day, if you look at the profit margins, those lab-made plant-based milks, they're significantly higher profits, right? It is all about, can I write a patent on this, intellectual property, complete market share, because big companies have realized that small-scale farming doesn't provide enough profit for them. So now how can we implement technology and lab-made food to increase profit margins and have a centralized food system that they maintain control of? So it's just we live in a wild time where we now think that it's okay that food is produced in a lab, and it's been normalized, right? Like plant-based alternatives, this is the norm. There's this funny reel going around where this guy is at a coffee shop and he's trying to place like a coffee order with milk. And the lady just keeps hearing him say oat milk, some version of oat milk, right? And he's like, whole milk.
That's funny.
And so we're now in this odd times where small scale regenerative agriculture, traditional food is not normal. We're weirdos. We're quacks.
Right.
We're somehow right hand politicians. We're Republicans because we retweeted one thing that RFK said, and now we're compartmentalized into this crazy quack world. It's like, no. We're going just back in time to what was actually working.
Yeah. Well, when people lose their health and then rely on cleaning up their diet to help their healing, that definitely is a paradigm shift in the mind for a lot of people. I am one of many people that have kind of had to go through that route. But, that's interesting what you say about the merging of the technologies. And it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. Like, I have chickens, and I would like an app that I can move their coop around.
Yeah. That's like, there's so much funding potential in regenerative ag, right? But instead it's going towards, hey, there's this lab-made milk that requires no animals, but we can make it in a lab because that's like green energy, carbon negative. Now there's Bill Gates is making butter made in a lab without requiring any animals. That's where the funding is going, because that's where intellectual property, market share, all this stuff.
Businesses have a responsibility to try to make more money.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny. I saw a post recently from a fairly popular, I guess, more like a fitness health influencer type person, saying that he'd be first in line to buy lab made meat. And it's like, yeah, I don't think it's the same. Even if it's chemically the same, there's a lot going on between the sun and the soil and everything in between that you're very naive if you think you could outsmart. There's information in that system that we don't see, hear, smell, taste, whatever, but it's that is our environment and we are a manifestation of it. And if you try to turn your environment into a lab, you're going to be a manifestation of a lab with cold floors and no heart and weird lighting and who knows what's in the air quality.
Yeah.
And like you said, the microbe thing, a teaspoon of cow juice or whatever, gut juice has more critters in it than there are people. How naive is it to think that we could just, I don't know, manhandle our way through these systems like we know better?
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing, there's two pieces to lab-made meat being better. Well, one thing that it's lacking is it won't compare nutritionally. So Dr. Stefan von Vliet created or made this research paper, I think in 2023, really transformative, where he basically did a meta-analysis of all these studies that no one paid attention to over the last 10, 20 years, where he documented that truly grass-fed regenerative meat contains phytonutrients, phytochemicals. These are things you only associate with plants. So you see green red peppers, you see purple eggplants, you see these colorful plants. Well, they're very much rich in phytochemicals. They're very anti-inflammatory. They provide a number of anti-cancer benefits. And it's very, like, mainstream acknowledges that these are very good for us, good for our gut health, everything. Well, Stefan von Vliet outlined that, hey, on a spectrum of grain-fed feedlot meat to regenerative grass-fed, grain-fed contains none of these. Grass-fed regenerative contains significant quantities and in amounts, in types that we don't get from a plant-based diet. So it adds more nutrients to a well-rounded omnivore diet because you are what you eat, right? And if a cow is eating diverse grasses out on pasture that we can't make use of, if we were to go eat those grasses that the cows are eating, we would just get sick. We wouldn't be able to, we don't have a four-chamber stomach to convert that into the nutrients that we need. Cows do. When cows eat those diverse grasses, we benefit because we're getting those unique nutrients that those grasses contain that we would never otherwise get in our diet. You can't put those in meat in a lab. You just can't. So there's the nutrition side of it. And then also there's the environmental piece. I think a lot of people talk about like government weather manipulation and various things like that. Well, I think the elephant in the room is that we've now completely transformed our agriculture lands. And we've, like I said in the beginning, we've got degenerative and regenerative. In degenerative landscapes, it's dirt. It's compacted. You get water runoff, meaning like if you've got a heavy rainstorm, the water basically hits the ground and it just runs off and it takes whatever chemicals with it, goes down the Mississippi River. And we see that in the Gulf of Mexico, we've got these like dead zones, right? That's chemicals accumulating and literally killing ecosystems and fish. Well, that water runoff, that's interfering with the natural water cycle that the environment is supposed to run on, right? That's having implications in our weather patterns that no one's really talking about. Because when you increase soil organic matter, which just means living microbes, soil structure that gets decimated when you do heavy tillage and heavy chemical use, that soil structure just becomes compacted. When you have these, it's like chocolate cake soil, living soil with ecosystem, microbes, and proper structure, you drastically increase water retention, which means you don't get that water runoff. Instead, the soil can soak in and hold more water, meaning the land is more resistant to droughts. It retains more water. It supports the natural water cycle. And then you get to the whole carbon, you know, carbon, green energy. That's a whole nother like conversation there, but
another day.
Another day. When you have healthy soil, you are supporting a natural carbon cycle,
right,
where there's carbon sequestration and then carbon leaves. Carbon sequestration, carbon leaves, and it's a natural flow of things. Cows out on pasture, not meat made in a lab, produces environments, ecosystems, soil health that allows the carbon and water cycles to function as they're supposed to, as they have for thousands, millions of years. And when we completely remove animals from pasture, we lose that. And what are the consequences of switching all of our food to lab made? I don't want to know. I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to be in an environment like that because there's going to be huge amounts of insects that we're going to have to use chemicals to fight. It's again, this like Bill Gates thinking that we're smarter and we can do things better.
Well, at least there's folks like you fighting a good fight. Yeah, soil is a big deal. I mean, I see it in my own yard. We have a garden. We have a nice garden and our soil is legit. And then right outside our garden, we have like dumb land that we try to grow grass. I can't even grow fucking grass on this. Like, it's like, I don't know what it is. It's like light brown and rocky and clay and all this. And like the soil's like this, it's black gold. It's like you could put your hands in it, it's like, this is life, you know? And that's important. Like, I don't I can't even articulate why it's important. Like, you can, but it's like anybody could just touch it and be like, yes, this is nature. Like, this is what we want to do. All right, I want to switch gears a little bit. So, yeah. And I don't want to simplify all the things that you do with your farm. I know you, and I think your sister, Sarah, is involved, and I'm sure you have a team that supports the operation. But there's definitely something that stands out as unique to your farm in regards to the feeds that you're using and how they're different. And I personally have been, and maybe I'm just gullible and easily sold by, like, health influencer people, whatever. Like, I've done all those diets too. I've tried all the things, and, you know, everybody eventually lands on repeat, I guess. But it's like, I've been scared to eat things high in poop food now in polyunsaturated fatty acids. So, the thing is it's like, it's taken these meats that I've always enjoyed, like chicken and pork, like out of my diet. And out of fear, and I hate that it's driven by fear. Like, that just doesn't sit well with me, because when I think about food and relationships and the connection and what it's about, like, I don't like fear being involved with that stuff. I'm like scared of it. And now, you know, I don't know how I originally saw what you guys were doing, but you're, I guess, feeding your animals a curated diet to help support not just their health, but our health by transferring the higher quality fats from them to us in that cycle. Can you talk about that?
Yep. So I totally agree with you. I think that too much of the health space is straight fear. And the reality is that fear sells, right? And it's also flashy, and it's what you can elicit an emotion within that 7-second attention span on social media. I am doing my best to try to not do fear. And instead of food fear, let's do food empowerment, where we understand why we're making the decisions that we're making, and we can feel the difference, right? So fear versus empowerment. So like I said in the beginning, I was born in the wrong era. I am obsessed with old-fashioned cookbooks. That's like my fun thing to read. I love reading about how they used to do agriculture in the 1800s. And the reality is that things have changed drastically. I think many people are aware that we've moved animals from pasture to CAFOs, confinement animal feeding operations. There's consequences to that, right? Because we're stuffing more animals in the same building that relies heavily on pharmaceuticals. So we're changing the environments that animals are living in, but we've also drastically changed the diet of animals. And again, back to the World War, that was our first like chemical-based war, right? So we developed a lot of chemical weapons used to fight in the war. Well, we spent way too much money on those chemical weapons, and we had to turn them into something. And if you take a step back and reflect on what the word pesticide means, if you break it up into the two pieces, pest, side. Side means kill. We are killing pests. So pesticide is this higher level term, and it involves, you know, herbicide, fungicide, insecticide, all these different pests that we're trying to kill. So we converted chemical warfare into pesticides, so that we can mass produce crops in a way that was never possible before, because now we've got these chemical agents. So these pesticides allowed us to scale corn and soy agriculture in a way that we've never before seen in history ever, right? So before this big change in agriculture, corn and soy was not mass produced the way that it is today. And many people don't realize this. I said this in the beginning. Over 50% of that corn and soy that's grown in the U.S. is used to feed livestock in these confinement animal feeding operations, but even livestock out on pasture, because that is just the norm. That's what we were born into. It's just where our generation is at today. That's what the current is in agriculture. It didn't used to be this way. And if you study the literature as much as I do, you can pull data and see there have been huge consequences. So two consequences. The first is the fatty acid composition in our eggs, in our chicken meat, in our pork, even now in our beef and in our dairy, it has changed. Like there's plenty of science documenting that we have less metabolism supporting saturated fats like stearic acid and more polyunsaturated fatty acids, PUFAs. And that's because the diet has changed. So we haven't just changed what we eat. We've also changed what the livestock eat through this mass industrial agriculture system. So we have less health supporting saturated fat, more polyunsaturated fat. So that's one change. The diets of the animals have changed. As a consequence, we have literally changed the insides of our bodies. We are made up differently than our great-great-grandmas. Our great-great-grandmas had more saturated fat, more stearic acid, and significantly less PUFAs than we do today. And that's because the fats that you eat make up the fats inside of you. They build structures. They send metabolism signals. They impact how your body produces energy. This, I believe in calories in versus calories out. I think that it's important for people to not overconsume a bunch of calories or undereat a bunch of calories, right? They should be consuming calories for their needs. But what many people don't realize is that the calories that we do consume in our diet impact the calories out because they're impacting our basal metabolic rates, our metabolisms. Through changing the types of fat that we eat, we have down-regulated our metabolism. We are not producing as much energy. We're storing more of our food as fat. And like, how obvious is this, right? Like, right. At what point do we just acknowledge the elephant in the room? Hello, the food system, it's not serving our health the way that it should be. We've got obesity and being overweight as just the norm. You look at those like beach pictures from like the early 1900s to today, it's like, oh my gosh, New York City, downtown, early 1900s to today, wow. And the food we eat every single day builds our insides and it also impacts how we take the food that we eat and convert it into cellular energy, ATP. So that's my biggest passion is, yes, the way that we raise animals is very important for our health and the environment, but also what we're feeding them changes the types of fat in the food that we consume, and that changes the types of fat inside of us, and it changes metabolic signaling inside of us as well. And that's my, I would say that that's the thing that I am like most excited about, and that's what gets me up every day and gets me so pumped because we started the farm in 2021. We started Nourish in 2023, so we're close to 2 years into Nourish Food Club. We still have a lot of things to figure out because distribution is a challenge, but I hope to be able to make a bigger impact with these things over time. Just people got to give me time. People yell at me for not like being able to help with this farm it's a lot. And I believe that we can rebuild the food system like collectively together. There's a lot of things to figure out. And unfortunately, like government subsidies and like food bills and things like that, and honestly, food laws are huge barriers, huge, huge barriers that get in the way of making this easy. It's very hard to do right now. And it's also very costly. So how can we kind of break down some like education barriers? Because people are still afraid of artery clogging saturated fats. And they think that PUFAs and seed oils are heart healthy. So we've got like the education barriers. We've got the, you know, chemical-based agriculture mindset that we need that. And then we've also got the billions of dollars invested into this conventional agriculture system where corn and soy is mass produced. Like that just can't go away because that's a lot of farmers' livelihood, right? So there's a lot of obstacles, but I do think that it's empowering to know, hey, by changing what the animals are eating and what they're, how they're living, we can make a huge improvement in the quality of the food. Because at Nourish, we're not just feeding animals differently. I believe we're feeding humans differently. And it's been really empowering to see people who have never been able to eat eggs before, never been able to eat bacon, chicken before, because those corn and soy allergies maybe pass through or their gut is sensitive to the high amount of PUFAs in them. So it's taking it a step further. And I think that I don't like to elicit fear, but the problem is there's a few steps for someone to understand in order to be at that empowerment state. So That's why I do like to be on social media and talk about these topics to try to break it down into simpler ways that people can understand. But that's at the end of the day, that is what our goal is at Nourish, is let's resaturate the food system.
Interesting. Well, I definitely think, Ashley, that you are in the right line of work.
Yeah, I think so. It took a long time to get here to figure out what I wanted to do, but I'm really honestly...
You know what you want to be when you grow up now.
Yes, I do. I do now. I do now.
That's great. It's great to see. Yeah, so I want to talk more about that. I mean, the fats in our foods have a tendency, because they are... We can make energy out of them, but they also have this big structural component where they make up our structures. They accumulate and we become more made of them. And they behave, different fats will behave differently. And there are certain things in our body, it seems, that are higher in fat as those structures. So, and they seem to be at really important areas. Like, from what I've learned, like anytime there's a membrane, anytime where there's like an interface with like an external environment of like a cell or a mitochondria, there's like all this really important stuff that happens. And these different fats, due to the way the carbons are bound together, whether they're stable or less stable, behave differently. And they could be, from what I understand, the more unstable the fat is, which what we see in these polyunsaturated fats, not that they're like inherently inflammatory, but they're like, they allow you to be more vulnerable to inflammation because they're quicker to, I don't know if oxidize is the right word, or break down or be reacted with. And it's funny because since I've gone low PUFA, and I know this is just anecdotal, but I've been mindful of PUFA for a while now, probably like 7 or 8 years. And I've heard other people say this. I know you're not going to see like a study on it or whatever, but I can't get a fucking sunburn if you paid me.
No, there's actually quite a bit of research on that.
Is there?
Okay. Really is.
I improved. Like, I grew up getting sunburn all the time. Every summer I would get sunburn. And I grew up on the standard American diet. Like, we had, I remember, country crock in our...
Oh, country crock butter. Butter. Country crock butter.
Yeah. In our fridge. And I loved it. I mean, that's what I knew. We had butter too that my mom would use to make like French toast, but like we would spread country crock on stuff. And we had canola oil in the refrigerator. And the thing is I like can't now. And I worship the sun more now than ever. I haven't worn sunscreen in well over a decade, probably close to two. And I just can't. And it's like, there's something to it. Like, I can't imagine it being anything other than the cell membranes of my skin have shifted the relationship of how much of the fat in those membranes are saturated and more stable from what they were when I was growing up.
Yeah, the phospholipid structure of your skin, like, people don't realize this. Your skin, there's fat. And that's not a bad thing, right? Like, it's normal to have fat on your body, right? Obviously, above a certain amount isn't good, but the composition of this changes based on your diet. And there's plenty of data showing the more PUFAs that you have in your skin, the more vulnerable your skin is to oxidative stress and damage. And then that leads your skin to be in a more susceptible state for sunburn. I haven't worn sunscreen all year. I used to burn real bad because I played golf. Now, sunburn is not really a problem. I actually pulled up some data that I have. Early 1900s, humans were 10% PUFA, 37% saturated fat, and 52% monounsaturated fat. Today, that 10% PUFA has increased to 21 to 23%. Our saturated fat has dropped from 37 to 24, and our MUFA is about the same, if not a little bit more. So, like, there are consequences to that shift in fatty acid composition, and we're kind of seeing that in real time. But yeah, the PUFAs, it makes up structures inside of you. Your body uses those PUFAs for fuel, and there's consequences to that. Polyunsaturated fats, PUFAs use up valuable oxygen, and that limits the amount that you can metabolize carbohydrates well. It limits your metabolic rate. There's the oxidation potential when you're enzymes are at an upregulated state. So it's just like, it's just not a great place to be in. You're leaving your body more susceptible to damage, downregulation of metabolism. My good friend Brad Marshall and I talk a lot about this concept. We're actually going to be starting a podcast dive into this more, because I think he, I don't know, there's a competition. He may be a little bit, no, I think we're about equal as obsessed with like fatty acid composition and how that impacts metabolism. But we like to talk about this term called subclinical hibernation. When a squirrel is getting ready for winter, the squirrel is going to gorge on unsaturated fat-rich nuts. And that is biological, right? There's a reason for that. They need to have a bunch of fat on their body to survive the winter with not much food access, right? And so they downregulate their metabolism because it's not advantageous to have a high metabolic rate when there's food shortage. You would die, right? You want there
to
be a slow.
So it's twofold for them. It's slowing them down and fattening them up to help them get through it.
Yep. And there's
so we just need to start hibernating a few months a year.
Problem solved.
You know what? Bill Gates is going to create hibernation clinics and solve this problem.
Very far away from those. No, everyone is living in a subclinical hibernation state. Dr. John Speakman, he published this paper in Nature where he has shown that the basal metabolic rate, BMR, of humans has gone down, even though our activity energy expenditure, so the amount that we move from exercise, has gone up. It has. It has gone up. Our BMR has gone down. Our average energy expenditure has gone up, and we still see weight rising, right? And so BMR, our basal metabolic rate, is the most important thing that impacts our calories out, whether or not we are burning and using the energy that we consume or we're storing. And something is downregulating our metabolisms. I think that PUFAs play a huge role, but there's also, you know, environmental obesogens like pesticides and plastics.
Any
and
stress could
phthalates
do
and stresses, yeah. So, for
there's
sure.
insults from all corners now. Not to be fearful, but it's just the environment we live in.
Yeah.
So before the 40s, 50s, like wartime, were these farming shifts, did these animals have lower PUFA diets?
Yep. More traditional in-season grains. And honestly, the food system back then was very much like cooperative, small-scale farm. And that's what we're trying to do with Nourish. And I think that there's potential to do that all over the U.S. It's like bring back small farms, right? And when you have smaller farms, you can do more food scraps. You can feed, you know, like every Halloween, after Halloween, I go to a local like pumpkin patch and I get all the pumpkins that weren't bought for Halloween and then go feed like 5 truckloads to the pigs, right? So various things like that, using more like scrappy things and whatever grains they had access to at the time. But there wasn't this like soy-based feed system. Soy was traditionally used for paint, because the PUFA is oxidized so easily, which makes it great for paint, right?
Oh, because it binds to the... Yes. That's like why I'm always freaked out when I go to season a pan.
Yes.
And it's like, you can't use saturated fat for that. You need a shitty fat because it won't work. And then I tell myself, like, it's just a little bit. It's just a little bit, and it's going to stay on there. Yeah. But yeah, so that's interesting. Used for paint.
Yeah.
So I mean, is this proprietary secret, but can you talk about what you feed your animals to fix this or make this problem better?
At this point, I can't.
Okay.
And that's just due to some NDAs and agreements that I've signed with a few other people. But
I understand.
I'm trying to make it, but give me some time. I want to make it more readily accessible and available for everyone. I'm just not at that place yet because at the end of the day, I am still kind of new to it, but we do have this amazing data. And I need some time to more fine-tune and tweak it. But there are so many other options for feed ingredients. Like, honestly, there's probably other options than what I do, right? But the issue is the system, because row crop farmers aren't compensated if they don't produce what is government subsidized. So the system is just encouraging this behavior of corn and soy, corn and soy, corn and soy, corn and soy. And it's feeding the livestock and it's just like the norm. It's also feeding, you know, like biodiesel and vegetable oil consumption for us and dried distiller grains.
And from what I understand, it's not even good business. The farmers don't do very well.
They're just stuck in it, right? Because the machinery required, like, it's $500,000 to buy a used machine to plant these fields. Some stuff is over $1 million, and that's not something you can just like walk away from, right? But back to the beginning, like the degenerative mindset, not mindset, the degenerative landscape every year requires more chemicals, more chemicals, more chemicals. It's just like more and more inputs, more and more inputs that they just get stuck in this cycle. But there's, you know, wheat's been used traditionally as a grain for a very, very long time. And I know wheat gets like poo-pooed on a lot, but there's like drawings on old Egyptian, like the old drawings on various tombs of them like harvesting wheat and making sourdough bread. Like wheat's been a part of many of our ancestors for a long time. Now, of course, there are some problems with modern wheats and things like desiccation, where glyphosate is used heavily to like dry the crop out and spray it with a lot of pesticides. But like wheat is a energy source that isn't super high in PUFAs that can be utilized. And there's so many other grains that it's kind of actually beautiful that every culture has like a traditional grain that was used for both humans to make bread, pasta,
often orange, fermented,
often fermented, things like that, but also used to feed the livestock as well. And it was almost like this co-companionship thing, right? There's so many options. There really are.
It's amazing what a piece of sourdough bread does to a meal.
Oh, I live sourdough.
I've been making sourdough since like COVID. I'm one of those COVID converts in sourdough. And like the difference of like my typical breakfast is like take leftover meat from dinner, add a couple eggs or 2 to 4 eggs, and I can enjoy that as it is. And have like a little dessert like cheese, honey or something, or some sugary, milky thing. But if you take that same meal and add a giant, crusty chunk of sourdough with butter, it's like all of a sudden I feel like a king.
Yeah.
Like my whole mood for the day has changed. Like, it's important.
Well, if you go back to like the 1800s, early 1900s cookbooks, you can also see their like, it's so funny. They didn't call them meal plans. They didn't call them grocery lists at the time. It was just like food lists, right? Because they would just go to their local market. Their food lists were like milk, bread, butter, sugar, produce in season, right? And bread was always like large quantities. And the problem is a lot of modern bread is kind of really not made great. There's seed oil snuck in. The wheat has been hybridized. It's filled with pesticides. There's a lot of other stuff in it, iron shards. But
iron shards? The fuck?
Fortified flour is a big problem today.
Okay.
That's another example of the
Bill Gates. Try to stay positive.
There's the Bill Gates problem where we're thinking that we can outsmart. So let's fortify our food, our flour with iron shards to solve the anemia problem. So now whenever you see flour at the grocery store ingredient list, it's fortified flour or enriched flour. So it's filled with not a great form of vitamin B6 or folic acid, and then also with iron shards, because we're trying to, like, again, we think we know better, but there are consequences to this, as Ray Pete has outlined heavily. But I am the same way. There's something different about breakfast when you got a nice thick chunk of sourdough there.
Yeah, or making French toast out of it.
Yes, that's...
It's so, like, satisfying on so many levels, and I just feel, like, fueled for the day. I love
it. Really is good. It really is good for you, too. Like, I know that people think, like, oh my gosh, you're making sourdough French toast. What a guilty pleasure. It's like, food should be pleasurable. Food should be good for you.
Yeah, I mean, I got eggs from that we feed. We pay, like, kind of a silly amount of money so we could feed our eggs like fancy dried worm stuff, and we give them chicken scraps and leftover stuff, and then they supplement with some grain. And then there's nothing like walking out, grabbing a few eggs, making French toast with sourdough that you baked yesterday, in a big chunk of like grass-fed salted butter, smothering it with organic maple syrup. I have like no regrets, and my lab works all great, my doctor says. So it's like, I don't think this is bad. Now, 10 years ago, I would have thought that was insane. And chasing it with a glass of orange juice. And I will add sugar to my orange juice.
Yeah.
And I feel fine. I love it. And the doctor says whatever you're doing is good. And I'm like, I think this is what people used to do.
This is an unpopular opinion. That is an ancestral diet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unpopular because of the grain, because of the bread component.
And the sugar and the orange juice and the maple syrup. But like, I'm sorry. Look, we've consumed sugar for thousands of years. And also, go look at the cookbooks in the 1800s. Everyone was metabolically healthy, doing well. Autoimmune wasn't a thing. Gut issues weren't a thing. Dairy, bread, sugar, fruit, meat, all the things that we're told not to eat these days by various circles, right? And we, again, elicit so much like fear, but we don't actually understand why. So people say this is bad, but if you were to ask them, why is that bad? They don't have an answer. They literally don't have an answer.
Or they say diabetes. Diabetes.
Exactly. Diabetes. Diabetes. And so I think that that's a big issue in the health space today is we've put fear around so much food. And I think that that's causing even more of a disconnect because then we're just, I don't even know what to eat anymore. And we don't live life. And it doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't. And yes, there's the standard American diet that has huge problems, but the extreme isn't like salads and chicken breast, you know, like that is not life. That's not ancestral. It's not. And I think finding that middle ground of you can eat these foods that taste good. You just need to pay attention to where they're coming from. And I think that's what the missing piece is.
I do have a 10-pound organic cane sugar bag on my subscribe and save every month. It's funny because my wife told me recently, like, the sugar just went from like just under 10 bucks to like over 13. I'm like, this is the Pete effect. These are Petarians and sugar dieters, you know, like skewing the whole demand curve of the whole sugar industry.
Diet. Yeah. It's interesting because now you're seeing a lot of keto carnivore people try the sugar diet and lose a bunch of weight. And then the keto carnivore influencers saying, you can lose weight, but there's going to be consequences down the line. Whereas like a few months ago, the message was sugar, fat gain, diabetes. And it's just that's why another reason, like I get more excited about food production and agriculture because the health space, oh gosh, it's
tough. Gets annoying. Yeah. Well, luckily there's the Jay Feldmans and the Mike Faves and the people out there that are just very good at communicating some of the basics. And the field that, you know, the end that you and your sister are taking is just going to be so important. And I'm excited. One, I'm just glad that it's available. Like sometimes I'm just happy I can get it. And also it's exciting to see, like, I am hopeful for the future because I think the younger generations are going to care more. And eventually, like you alluded to a couple times, how businesses have these incentives where they are kind of stuck in there, but those businesses eventually are going to be all new people and they're going to be from a different generation and they're going to have different mindsets and find different solutions and ask different questions. And it's an exciting time to be able to watch it unfold. And like farms like yours are popping up. Like it wasn't long ago where it would be really hard to get well-raised food, like delivered 2 days after you order it, frozen, safe and all that. And now it's like, we have options and it's great.
Yeah. That's what I, one of our biggest challenges right now, and it's something that I think is definitely needed. Everyone's been like Amazon, even myself, right? And I think that that's okay. Modern technology allows for distribution, delivery, and things like that. Unfortunately, I think grocery stores are kind of, I don't know what's going to happen to grocery stores in 5 years, basically, because do people go to grocery stores as often anymore? I'm not sure.
Well, hopefully they're not all government owned where you have to.
Yeah. And also it's hard to know the sourcing of grocery stores and various things like that. So more and more people are wanting to know where their food comes from, but also they may live in cities and they don't have 6 hours a week to drive 3 hours away to a farm and 3 hours back. And I think the convenience of modern delivery, that is an interesting technology to leverage in modern times so that we can have access to old fashioned ancestral food.
Yeah. So ideally, you would just go to your farmer's market locally. Like, where I live in the burbs between Baltimore and D.C. Like, I don't want to eat animal that's raised around here.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I want to move to where the air is cleaner. Like, I don't want to, it's, I don't find like it's a clean environment.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah. I want my animals raised in the middle of the country.
Yeah.
Or New Zealand or something like that. I know it's not perfect, but that's how I feel.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love, you know, maybe that'll change. That's going to be a tough thing to change. But I would assume that if more farms pop up, that in itself is going to help improve the environment and 100%. Make, you know, space cleaner outside.
100%.
Ashley, I like I said, I want to extend my gratitude from my family to you and yours for all the stuff you do. And I'm going to get over my fear and help promote you with the risk of losing out on supply.
No, you'll always have a spot. You'll always have a spot.
I really appreciate you taking the time and chatting with me. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you. And I'm excited that you're out there doing what you're doing. And I am honored to help be a conduit for your message. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Like I said in the beginning, we really are changing the food system together, because I think that I want to help, like, encourage and empower consumers. Like, you are a part of the change, right? I know it seems so scary and large task, but when given the opportunity, if you have the financial resources to do so, who and where you buy your food from, it makes a huge impact. It really, really does over time. And so I think moving to that empowerment stage, when you get out of that food fear and you start in this food empowerment, that's where you can start being like, you know, I'm going to make better food sourcing decisions, and I'm going to buy here. I'm going to support here. So I think it's a partnership, and it's a part of being human, of knowing your farmer.
Well, it's nice to have chicken and pork back in my life. And by the way, my wife told me to tell you, she loves the maple breakfast sausages.
Yay!
Big fan.
Yes, great.
Well, for the listeners, always grateful you're listening. If they want to learn more and try to acquire some of your yummy food, where do they go?
www.nourishfoodclub.com.
All right. Thanks again for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the episode.
Thanks so much.